Well, good afternoon, everyone. I appreciate folks sticking around at this late hour. Your stomachs are probably growling right now a little bit. But anyway, what I would hope to do today is just to present some survey results of a very involved and comprehensive study that was done in Anniston, Alabama. And like the other presenters today, I have no relationships to disclose at this time. And before I get into the talk, I do want to acknowledge the support of many people who, without their help, that the project would not have been able to be successful. And what's listed at as the last one, the citizens of Anniston, Alabama, which we're going to talk, is really, they should be listed first. This is a study that was really brought about by the community, in that the community was very interested in their own perceptions of PCB contamination. And then, of course, there was a larger group of researchers involved within in the project. So what I want to do today is just to talk about really what is one small component of the research that was done. And here what I want to do is just to talk about what the community self-reports as their health conditions, as the health problems that the community has. In addition, I also want to talk about their perceptions of PCB exposure and then the associated negative health effects that folks have felt that they've had as a result of their exposure. And just as a bit of background, Anniston, Alabama is in, as you can see there, in kind of northeastern Alabama. And it is a relatively small town, only about 26,000 people, which is actually a declining population there, split evenly demographically between whites and African Americans. There's a slightly higher rate of poverty in Anniston than in the rest of the state. And then there's just a couple of photographs there about the city. It's actually a nice little community, or as people living there would think that it could be even a nicer little community. Before I get into the study itself, just to give a history of PCBs in Anniston. For 40 years or so, PCBs were manufactured at a plant in Anniston for use generally as electrical insulation. The contamination from the production of PCBs in Anniston was spread really through two ways. One was through drainage, in that from the plant there are a couple of creeks that feed into the city and then back out of the city, of which there was a lot of dumping that was done into the waterways. And then secondly, other PCB chemicals were, I'll say, dumped into a landfill, and for various reasons, the fill dirt that was part of this landfill was then sent to houses as topsoil and backfill for houses. So dirt that was contaminated was spread from the dump to many houses. As a result of the contamination and the production, which had ended in 1971, so there hasn't yet, in the last 35 years or so, there hasn't been any additional production of this. And matter of fact, in the mid-70s, that the production of PCBs were banned. However, there has been a series of lawsuits, litigation. There's been payouts to the population. Depending upon which lawsuit you were a part of, you might have got a pretty fair amount of money. For other people, it might have been a smaller amount of money. In addition, working through CDC and other agencies, there's been a lot of remediation, in that a lot of the contaminated topsoil has been removed in, I think, upwards of 600 houses or so. And so there's a lot of consequences of the exposure, or excuse me, of the contamination. Well, why was that important? Well, the EPA, as noted here in a report in 2002, noted some of the suspected health effects from PCB exposure. You can see listed there the probable carcinogen, suppressed immune system, some reproductive problems, neurological problems, developmental problems, hormonal problems that are suspected based upon PCB exposure. And so what we wanted to do was to go into the community and say, hey, folks in the community, what are the actual problems that you have? And then of those problems, what are you attributing to PCBs? So we went into the city and conducted over 1,100 interviews with randomly selected adults in their households, asked them an extensive list of questions, health conditions, quality of life, depression, perceptions of the community, work history, all sorts of things. In addition, we asked people who participated in the survey if they would come into our office and in the office go through a set of physical measurements and a blood draw. With the blood draw, what we did is we actually have measured levels of PCBs in people's blood, which is probably the most interesting thing of the study, but something that I'm not going to focus on today. I will say, though, that I will mention some of the interesting results that have come from that, though, from other people. Just a couple of slides just talking about the sample characteristics, about an even split between males and females, again, about an even split between African Americans and whites. Education, age, and income, as you can see listed there, the income within the study matched pretty closely with the income of the town, where many people, as you can see, over a third had incomes of under $20,000. So let's first talk about the health conditions. In the survey, we asked people a basic question: has a doctor or other health professional ever told you that you have? And then we have a list of 32 health conditions. And the ones that are most frequently reported are the ones that I'll be presenting here and on the next slide. So as you can see within the population, that almost half have been told that they have high blood pressure, and another 40% or so have allergies. As you get down the list a little bit, I'll come back to this, but I want to point this out, is the rate of diabetes and high blood sugar. As we have found in the study, that the population here has a tremendously high rate of diabetes. Some of the other health conditions, as you can see listed there, heart disease, asthma, going down to cancer, and heart attacks is 11%. The population that we studied, though, if you tally up the number of health conditions that each person has, as you can see that the community itself, I don't want to say characterize it as being a sick community, but people have multiple health problems. As you can see, on average, or the median, is that were 4 of the 32 conditions, and that only 10% of people did not have any of the conditions that were listed. And what I think is probably the biggest thing at the end there is that a quarter of the people had 7 or more, that they had a huge number of health problems with of those that we asked about. And then before I leave the slide, just the last thing, someone had actually reported up to 18, so well over even half of the problems that have had. So just a couple of comparisons here, just to kind of put it into context. We asked people, as you can see the question there, in general, would you say your health is excellent, very good, fair, or poor, which is kind of a standard question in the behavioral risk factor surveillance system and is asked in numerous other studies. Aniston is in red, and as you can see there, that the health conditions, that the ratings of the general health, people in Aniston have a higher number of poor and fair, and then fewer numbers of people who rate their health as excellent or very good compared to Alabama and compared to the national averages. Okay. So what I want to turn to now is a little bit more about the perceptions of exposure. We asked people a general question about the rating of the air, water, and soil quality in Alabama, or in Aniston, excuse me. And as you can see, it's trending towards the poor, very poor side, that people feel that their community does not have good air, water, or soil quality. And just a couple of demographic differences. In general, females, African Americans, and people who live in West Aniston, which was closer to the manufacturing plant, generally rated the environmental quality worse than males, whites, and people who live further away from the plant. As you might expect, that given kind of the history of the litigation and stuff, almost everybody was aware of the PCB contamination. And many people have been involved in litigation, and folks have had their measurements, PCBs measured at their home and in their blood previously, as you can see listed there. The ratings of the contamination, as you can see, very severe, especially within the city. Almost half of the people think that the contamination is very severe, although in their own neighborhoods it's a little bit less so. How worried are people? As you can see, it's a kind of a nice dichotomy almost there, in that you have a group of people who are extremely worried about it, and then there's another larger group who are not worried at all about it. As we heard in the previous presentation about, you know, the problems that this can cause in a community, some of the negative social aspects that result from this have also been found here in Anniston. Ask people about if they've been personally exposed. 2/3 think that they have, and most of them will rate those as a high level of exposure. And then of those, have you had a negative health effect? 2/3 also said yes, that they've had. And then how severe is that health effect? As you can see, people are rating the negative health consequences as being very severe. Some of the conditions that people are saying that they are associating with PCB exposure: allergies, asthma, cancer, diabetes, high blood pressure, rashes and skin problems, as you can see listed there. Those ones were self-reported. In addition, we asked people this list of conditions, you know, do you think that these conditions are related or not related to PCB exposure? And as you can see, cancer, birth defects, and developmental problems were the ones that most people said were associated with PCBs. And then kind of following along with the environmental differences, females, African Americans, and West Anniston residents generally felt that they had more exposure and were suffering more health consequences as a result of their exposure. And then one interesting thing, the risk behaviors that are a part of determining some of the PCB exposure. Eating things that were produced locally, eating fish from the creeks that were contaminated, as you can see, a lot of people are doing these things. The one that I want to mention just that's listed in black there of eating clay, is kind of a cultural practice there, where we can see that over 1/3 of the folks have eaten clay. And all of those are associated with increases in exposure. So just in a general summary, most adults have felt that they've had multiple health conditions. They rate the quality in the environment as not very good. That people are very aware of the PCB contamination. It's is probably the guiding kind of underlying sentiment within the community, is the PCB exposure. The idea of stigma is being tossed about there. And as you can see, just kind of in the summary slide, just kind of comparing what people think that PCB's exposure is related to, what they have felt themselves, and then what has been shown in other studies, there are some similarities between those, the cancer, developmental problems, and diabetes. And then lastly, I just kind of wanted to conclude here on some of the educational implications. Now, we've heard some talks today about scientific literacy, other contaminated communities and the effects of there. And here what we're trying to look at is that within this community, there's a great awareness of PCBs, and there's a large attribution of that exposure, the perceived exposure, to a wide variety of health conditions. So within the kind of the educational component of what we would want to do going back into the community and to talk about that is really twofold, or actually threefold as we'll go there. We would want to be able to tell the community how sick they are. Is it really something that's different? And then are things related to PCBs, you know, what can we do about it? As you saw previously, you know, high blood pressure was kind of the number one condition that was listed. Well, even if there's a relationship with PCBs, there are things behaviorally that you can do to help reduce your blood pressure. Diabetes was one that I had mentioned earlier, is that we have a high rate of diabetes, and there are, there's lots of behavioral things that you can do to try to help control or minimize or prevent diabetes from occurring. And And so as I just want to conclude here, one thing that I do want to mention again is that this was something that was really driven by the community, and that there's been a lot of, I'll say a lot of problems, but a lot of division within the community related to PCBs, who thinks it's a serious problem, who thinks that it is not. The consequence within the community has really divided the community, neighbor against neighbor. You got a lot of money off your lawsuit. We didn't get much money off of our lawsuit. But the community did get themselves together, at least to want to say, you know, what is going on within our community and what kind of problems are a result of this. So the survey here, just the brief things that I've talked about today, are kind of the first step in going about and addressing that. In the longer term, as I mentioned, though, we don't have the results presented here. We did do a blood draw looking at actual exposure and then other conditions, glucose levels, lipid levels, and those kind of things. So results from those kind of things will also be coming out as further analyses are done. So with that, thank you, and have a good night. Yeah, actually, I think the two things I will say related to that is that in some of the preliminary analysis that we've done is that there was not a great relationship between the perception of exposure and their actual blood levels, in that the people who were highly exposed were not always the ones who felt that they were highly exposed, and vice versa. And then secondly, the people who had been involved in litigation in the past, they were also tend to think that their exposure was larger. But again, with the actual measures that we have so far, there wasn't a great relationship with that.
Yeah, I could make up a chart and say which of the contaminants or sources they said might cause those health problems, which ones do I think are correct and which ones are not. But I didn't do that because it's not a representative sample. But and people actually were pretty good. I mean, there weren't a lot of misperceptions, I would say. But pretty much the public didn't, again, think upstream, like it was smog, it was chemicals you ate, and that was about as specific as it got, and there was no link to chemicals to a particular health problem. It's chemicals. So in that respect, it's, you could call it erroneous, or you could call it, not very precise. The question is it important if you buy into this idea of, or if we think about the filter of what people really need. Not everyone needs to be able to answer that. At least the argument of vernacular science and education is that we need to build these networks around people, so if they do have a problem or they perceive a problem, they have a place to go to work it through, and that people inherently have that sort of that ability to do it. That sort of is my maybe not very well-made point. But in general, people, I think the public did... It was interesting as they thought through it and kind of just sort of stumbled around about trying to find answers, came up with some interesting and correct associations about pathways and exposures. They couldn't be very specific about a particular contaminant coming from a factory, but they could kind of work through, it's here and it's got here through some kind of source that made sense. So, again, it's that sort of, I do think it's... I don't think everybody has to know everything, but intuitively, people can, if they have questions, they can find out the answers, perhaps. And there's a lot of literature to a burgeoning literature to say that this is true. You have community-based approaches where you can maybe not teach them the how-to, the real deep content of science, but you teach them the networks and the resources to be able to answer those questions as they come about.
So kind of looking at the, like, the quality of life or depression or?
Anxiety.
Yeah. Yeah, trying to think if we've looked at any of that at this point yet. I think what we did find, without trying to misstate anything, is that the people who were more worried about the contamination or worried about their exposure, you know, they did have, if I'm remembering properly, they did have lower scores when we were looking at quality of life. That was also associated more with, trying to think, kind of some of the general attitudes about. I'm sorry, I'm not remembering very well, but yeah. So, what I expect to find with that, though, is that there is a relationship, that those people who are more concerned about the problem or who have a greater sense of worry, I anticipate that we'll find that that would follow along with a decreased quality of life and maybe increased levels of depression. But I'm not sure that that's exactly what we will show. Right. We actually, that question came up very early in the design of the study, was do we want to look at a control community to see if what kind of comparisons there are. And forces above me decided that the funds that we had would not allow us to go in and to do another community. But what we do plan on doing is at least taking for those variables that we can find some comparable data for reports from, say, Alabama in general or nationally, is to try to look at some comparisons there and see what kind of rates are different within the Anniston community. For example, diabetes, much higher than national average, but also much higher than what was found in Alabama.
I think the typical sort of model has been a real top-down, I'm going to impart to you the information you need to make a decision, and that if I teach you the skills to make a decision, you're going to make a good decision. I mean, that is the premise of sort of environmental science education and the whole movement and reform, to teach people skills so they can have that logic. And I think, you know, that's one point. The other counterpoint is actually a lot of community-based participatory research and citizen involvement is saying, well, maybe you need those skills, but you know, maybe we have to build a different kind of way to think about about how that information gets filtered, because not everyone is going to have this. Not everyone is going to have the time or the interest to actually go about and learn that, learn that from that top-down approach. But if we can do it in a way where the whole community gets involved and people are talking to each other, and instead of me coming to you and handing you a piece of paper, it's your neighbor sitting there going, but there's a lot of PCBs around here. Why don't we go look on the internet, and then I'm going to call you up later. And it's not me, the educator, saying, here's the answer. It's me, the educator, creating a framework where people are going to talk more to each other and use their own social support mechanisms to find out the answer. I mean, that really is a different way of thinking about it. So it's trusting that people have, even if you haven't taught them, they have the skills to have a collective intelligence. And that's really, you can tell I've been taking a course in distance learning. That's Web 2. people can find out answers. But there is still a role for science educators and educators in general, that is to helping to shape the experience where, this year example would be good. There's people there who there's a disconnect between perception and reality. Where rather than going in and putting up a poster, which is what I would do, a health educator, poster, here's PCBs, he would say, let's get together and let's look at this together. And I'm not going to tell you what the answer is, but let's go to some resources and do it. And then the people in the community go home and they say, I'm going to call up my mother. And we're going to talk about it. We're going to find ways to find the answer. There is still a correct answer, so to speak, but maybe we don't need so many filters of formal education to come to that. And that is, and I'm not the first one to say that is actually the whole movement of participatory research and a citizen movement in science, which is a really different paradigm. And I'm not actually sure if my data showed that there were some differences, but my data also showed that, community people, they might not have had the depth, but they had the breadth, and that maybe it's just a really different way to think about education of science, because we can't know. Right, it's true. We can't know everything, right? And maybe we don't need to. But if people do find out what they need to know, and if we shape experiences where we can kind of prompt them to say, prompt them or raise awareness enough to say that this is indeed something that may be important to you, then they're going to go out and find out information. And it is true. There's a lot of other social science stuff that goes with that, because men are worse than women at it. SES relates to access to information. There's a lot of other variables that go into it. But shaping the experience so we can learn from each other and having people involved and feeling it relevant is that sort of model of citizen scientist or citizen. So that's not the way we're taught, is it, Chisholm? And we think science has traditionally been this very top-down, people up here, and it's a really different way of trusting that the community can find solutions if they're given the tools to do it. So, all these examples that we're talking about tonight are things that have some connect with that idea of social support and expanding social networks to solve the problems.
As measures that we had from the blood draw included the PCB levels, we looked at lipid levels, glucose levels, autoimmune levels, and there might have been one other thing that that was looked at in relationship to that. Whether what came first, the exposure or the condition, we won't be able to most likely to be able to distinguish that. We'll just be able to look at the association between the two. And so, for example, with diabetes as an example, what other researchers involved in the project have shown is that for people who were exposed to PCBs, what we tended to see was an increase, a rather markedly large increase in the rate of diabetes among people who were relatively young, I say between 30 and 50 years old, but as how they work together, we probably would not be able to distinguish.
Do you see that the students who graduate from the course have an increased use of environmental histories in their practice, and more
Okay, I mean, she was a MPH, MD student.
Well, I would say even with that, most people. I like the science literacy and stuff, because the population, you know, they probably heard anecdotally, and you know, they'll remember the bad things and the stuff that people have done before, but you know, as far as understanding the science behind what things have, that's, you know, I don't know that there's that great understanding.
Transcripts, we didn't know who said what, so we couldn't actually do it.
So I could,
that would be a great idea.
When we did ours, we videoed audio, and so we could identify speakers, and we eventually, because there's so much litigation, there are
Thank you.